In Tokyo, my name is Fernando Gore.
And in Hong Kong, my name is James Marsh, and welcome to the Society for Film. On today's show, we're going to be discussing Ridley Scott's The Counselor, the popular documentary Waiting for Superman, and Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave. How are you, Fernando?
Not too bad. Enjoying the fall colours here. Fall, I sound like an American. The autumn colours here in Tokyo. It's lovely shades of yellow and orange. And the cooler nights and longer evenings are definitely conducive to watching more films in the lead up to Christmas.
Oh, definitely. You know, and it's that time of year when we get all the big worthy awards contenders that we're supposed to sort of stroke our chins at and consider on a number of more cerebral levels than we would otherwise with the summer popcorn entertainment.
Exactly. The does this deserve an award kind of films?
Exactly. To look deep within ourselves and find a conscience somewhere.
Now, our first film is one that tries to ask us to look deep within ourselves, and I think it's fair to say probably had worthy ambitions. It certainly feels like it did. This is Ridley Scott's The Counselor. Now, Ridley Scott is a director that I think it's fair to say both of us are fans of some of his previous work, if not most of his previous work.
Oh, that's certainly fair to say, yes.
And I think it's also fair to say that both of us are not fans of his last film.
Definitely. For all its beauty and good intentions, yes, Prometheus falls flat on its arse.
Well, was absolutely terrible. Now, Ridley Scott is back again. He's left space behind him, and he's in the contemporary United States in a gritty, noirish kind of story, originally penned by Cormac McCarthy.
That's right. I mean, I think this is the first original screenplay by Cormac McCarthy. I think the story goes that Ridley Scott had been trying to get Blood Meridian, an adaptation of that famous Cormac McCarthy novel, off the ground for a long, long time, and it didn't happen. And so McCarthy said, well, I have this screenplay that I've written. And so, you know, understandably, Ridley Scott jumped at the opportunity and managed to pull together a pretty stellar A-list cast to help him get it off the ground.
It's an extraordinary cast. I mean, we've got Michael Fassbender, we've got La Penelope, Cameron Diaz, Javier Bardem, Brado Pitto. It is a very strong cast, and all of them get to look quite good on the screen as well. Well, possibly with the exception of Rosie Perez, who is in jail, sans makeup, and looks kind of a little bit tired. But everybody else looks. It's some kind of mix between glamorous and extraordinarily out there.
Yeah, there's this horribly garish sort of kitsch element to the film, which is quite funny because you see a lot of that in Hong Kong, actually, because you get a lot of these very flush mainlanders coming down to buy all their luxury goods, and they're just dripping in brand names and gold and, you know, incredibly expensive outfits, but with no accounting for taste whatsoever.
I thought it was I don't know if this ad has been playing in Hong Kong, but I thought it was kind of apropos that the cinematic ad that screened before the film was the latest Louis Vuitton ad, the one with David Bowie in it. Have you seen that?
I haven't, actually.
Okay, no. I mean, these kind of high fashion ads can be extraordinarily pretentious, and this one has, it's shot in Venice or some other beautifully picturesque European city, and it has a young woman in a fantastic dress descends into the city square in a hot air balloon, leaves the hot air balloon and enters this large ballroom where this party is going on. Everybody is dressed in kind of sort of 18th century regal gowns, and as the crowd parts, she sees David Bowie, sitting at a harpsichord, singing the song "I'd Rather Be High," the opening lyrics of which are, "Nabokov is sunlicked now upon the beach of Grunewald, brilliant and naked, just the way that authors look." And the whole thing is so tasteless and replete with pretension that I just can't help but laugh every time that ad comes on. It's been screening regularly here and before films in Tokyo.
Oh, right. No, I've not seen that one here at all.
And to be honest with you, for the first half an hour of The Counselor, I had similar kinds of feelings.
Right.
Because the film starts and it kind of tries to get you in pretty quickly. It is a sort of, I guess it's fair to call it a caper kind of film.
Yeah, it's a noir crime thriller, I'd call it.
Yeah, but there is this veneer of tasteless superficiality.
Mm.
Right the way through. I mean, Javier Bardem just looks ridiculous. He has this kind of electric shock hairdo. And like you say, the worst of this over-the-top, more cash than taste dress style.
Right.
Cameron Diaz also doesn't look much better with a really extreme, harsh haircut, a kind of shave to one side thing, an obsession with cheetahs, and even a quite fetching cheetah tattoo that seems to run all the way down from her neck down to her...
I think it goes down her leg. I think it goes all the way down one side of her, doesn't
all
it?
All the way down one side of her, exactly. And
like she should be in the X-Men or something.
she should be in something, but it really kind of... it has this... I remember you described Trance...
Yeah,
as a little bit trashy, right? And this feels like a lot a bit trashy.
Yeah.
It has a kind of 70s excess to it.
Yeah,
in its visual style, and it really doesn't let that up. It's there's very little subtlety to the way this presents itself.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I think what the film tries to do is the thing that Cormac McCarthy succeeds for the most part in his novels, which is to create this kind of philosophical, to take this philosophical angle and apply it to sort of a crime film.
Hmm.
What this film very quickly exposes is that outside of his regular sort of prose trappings, he's pretty incapable at doing that with any degree of subtlety or nuance whatsoever. When it comes to writing dialogue, for these characters, he's all over the place. And I think while the film does have at its I'm not sure if I want to say at its core or on its surface, that the noir thriller sort of aspect to it, I thought was quite fun, and I quite enjoyed the sort of the trashy cliches and nuts and bolts sort of thriller elements to the film. The whole thing is coated in this sort of garish, ghastly sheen of tasteless wealth, but at the same time is underpinned by this sort of cod philosophical musing that every character seems to sit around and talk about what it really means to live your life in this particular way, and you have to understand that, you know, everything can change on the roll of a dice, and you know your life is perpetually in the balance and all this kind of thing. And that for me, that doesn't work at all. I think that's been a fairly sort of common takeaway from this film, but it's incredibly strange.
Yes, I really found myself oscillating between some extreme poles in my reaction to the film. I mean, the dialogue, you bring up the issue of the dialogue, and I completely agree with that. The film opens in a quite beautifully shot scene. Michael Fassbender and La Penelope are in bed together.
Oh, yeah.
And we kind of, the camera sees them under the sheets, and then we come in under the sheets. Two people who are obviously in love and infatuated with each other. But the dialogue between them is so ham-fisted.
It's horrible.
It's really cringeworthy. And you simultaneously have this experience of wanting to look at them, because Michael Fassbender is not a bad-looking bloke.
He is a handsome man.
Right, and La Penelope is La Penelope. So you've got the two of them, and you want to look at them, but you also don't want to listen to what they're saying, because it is so trite. And then all the way through the film, you have a number of these set-piece dialogues. And often they are Michael Fassbender talking to somebody else.
Yeah.
And somebody else is revealing some kind of profound truth. He He has one with a diamond merchant in Amsterdam. He has another moment which is all about love and commitment. He probably has two that are about love and commitment to a woman with Javier Bardem's character. And then he has one profoundly moving one towards the end of the film in the climax with a Mexican cartel leader. Mm. And these all purport to reveal something profound about life and human experience and love and destiny and the meaning of it all. But they are just so leaden, right? And
yeah.
And tiresome. And you can see what the idea that's trying to be communicated is.
Mm.
And the idea is actually a worthy, interesting philosophical idea. But as a movie experience, sitting through those scenes, only one of them feels worthwhile. And it actually feels worthwhile because it is so absurdly and luridly comical. That it probably stands up there with the trashiest moments of Trance as well. I guess I felt often that there was a similarity between Trance and The Counselor.
Yeah, no, that's not a bad comparison at all. I hadn't actually thought of that, but both of them have this very glossy, sort of over-processed, you know, sort of hyper-technicolor kind of sheen to them. But I think you're right with the as far as the conversations go. I think they're over analyzing and over philosophizing what are essentially archetypal tropes of this kind of film. And I think anybody that has seen sort of any fair smattering of genre film or crime film or this kind of heist film, you know, understands these, even if they haven't fully articulated them either, you know, in conversation or in their heads. And having to sit through, you know, probably half the film, you know, of various characters pointing these things out to each other and saying, hey, you know, essentially what we're doing is pretty risky.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we're not being very responsible with our lives, and however the risks are sometimes worth it.
And this might have consequences.
Well, exactly. You know, we might feel a little guilty afterwards, is essentially what they're saying to each other. You're like, yeah, I know, I understand, you know, what it's like, or not I understand what it's like to be one of these characters, but I understand these characters.
Yes.
And I understand the situation that they're going in. I think it's such a huge obstacle getting in the way of what could have been something far more trance-like, as in the film, which was, you know, so gloriously, deliriously trashy and reveled in the ridiculousness of its aesthetic and its situation. And it was just out to have a good time. Whereas The Counselor has some wonderful moments in it. Some of the sort of the big crimes of set pieces in the film. There's a piece with a motorbike,
yeah,
on a deserted highway that's amazing. And there's you know, pretty much, I think, everything that involves Brad Pitt in the film, I was really quite impressed by him. I think he had an ability to sell that dialogue in a way that Javier Bardem couldn't really articulate, or that Michael Fassbender couldn't really get across. There was something about Brad Pitt's delivery that I really, really enjoyed in this film.
I think it's interesting, too, that he plays possibly the least complex character. It feels like I do agree that he's probably the most compelling persona in the film.
Good,
but he's also not asked to do as much as the others are.
Well, he's like he's almost the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the piece, isn't he? He's like the wise old sage who's been there and done it, and and is instructing Michael Fassbender in, you know, I mean, just to set up the plot very quickly, which we haven't done for anybody that hasn't seen it.
Yeah.
Michael Fassbender is the counselor of the title. He's a lawyer who's fallen in love with Penelope Cruz, and they're going to get married. And so he wants to build a nest egg. And so he decides to come in on a heist. Is it? It's diamonds, isn't it?
It's a big drug deal.
It's a drug shipment.
Deal.
Yeah, and he decides to come in. He's friendly with a crime a gangster, essentially, played by Javier Bardem, and he decides to come in on one deal in order to get a big return and to go off and marry his lady love. Mm. And, oh, unsurprisingly, things don't go quite as smoothly as you might have anticipated, and he descends into a, you know, a netherworld of consequences.
Yeah. And Brad Pitt is really the one who has the greatest sense that things will eventually go wrong.
It's inevitable in this world.
It's inevitable that things will go wrong, and you have to do your best to be prepared for them. But it's interesting. I mean, he reprises a lower key version of himself in the Fight Club.
In Fight Club.
And so in a sense, it's Brad Pitt in a familiar role. And he does very well with it. Whereas, you know, Michael Fassbender is asked to give us a quite wide range of emotions.
Yeah, it's a performance I haven't really seen from Michael Fassbender before. You know, he tends to do these either period pieces or very sort of introspective, you know, character pieces. But this is him, you know, clearly embracing something that he thought would be a bit of a laugh and a good fun time. And I think he gives it his all. I don't think he's bad at all in it. He's too good of an actor to do it. But it's an interesting choice, though, I think.
Yeah, I don't know that. I probably would say that I'm not sure anybody is really bad in this.
Okay, well, there is one person.
Well, I'm probably going to disagree with you here. I'm not sure anybody is really terrible in this. And I think you are right that there are definitely set pieces and moments in the film that are entertaining. You know, this isn't a terrible film, and it isn't a hardship to watch, largely because it's visual candy. Although I did feel like it's too long. This weighs in well over 2 hours.
Yeah, it's about 2 1/4, I think, isn't it?
Exactly, and given the ponderously self-indulgent philosophical dialogue, it's a little bit unforgivable that it goes for so long. Mm. I think a lot more of the problems really are in its ambition to try and be so profound.
Definitely.
And I think in the clunkiness of the dialogue, which doesn't help the fact that, which is not helped by the fact that two of the main characters are not native English speakers.
I didn't find that so much of a problem. I mean, because the part of the story is obviously about the cartels and what have you.
Yeah.
I found that McCarthy's biggest problem is that he cannot write for women. There are two. I mean, one of the characters who we haven't mentioned at all actually is Cameron Diaz.
Yeah,
and she plays Javier Bardem's girlfriend, who is, you know, clearly has a very strong hold over him and influence over him. And as the plot unfolds, we find out that her involvement is, you know, increasingly important and integral and powerful within the machinations of the caper and the crime itself. But I found that the dialogue, pretty much anything she said and pretty much anything Penelope Cruz said, and oh god, the one scene by the pool that they have to get together is the most uncomfortable, awkward, just bafflingly unrealistic conversation I've heard on screen in a very, very long time. And you know, I alluded to the fact earlier that I think one of the performances is not good. And it's a shame, and it's quite a complicated issue here, because I think that Cameron Diaz's character is fantastic. I think she's just such a vile, horrible... She's playing like a Puerto Rican...
Bahaman, but some kind of Latin background as well.
You're not sure
if you can really believe anything she says.
She claims to be Bahaman. I think she's probably supposed to be of mixed descent, and she's clearly out just to make as much money by hanging out and falling in with Javier Bardem, who is utterly, absolutely besotted with her. He knows that she's a bad girl and that she's trouble, essentially, but he can't help himself. And he some of the things he has to come out with and say about, you know, his musings about women are just ridiculous. But
Yeah, and quite amusing. And she is quite upfront with him that when the going gets tough, she'll leave him.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's no sweetness or tenderness in her at all, really.
Right. And I don't think we're going to discuss how the film plays out, but it really comes as no surprise. But it's at the same time, it's quite impressive to see just where it does go. But I'm unfortunately, as gloriously crass and garish and horrible and tasteless and over the top and vile her character is in almost every single way, I really don't think Cameron Diaz had the chops for it. She gives it a spirited attempt, but I think for every moment that hits home and you're like, ugh, I hate this person, you then go, ugh, I hate this actress. I hate this performance. She's really, you know, she fails to sell as many of the moments that she manages to do.
Is that her or her dialogue, though? Because I felt that one of the issues with her character was that what she gets to say,
yeah,
doesn't rise above what she looks like.
Well, I think you only need to look at every other character in the film to see that, you know, a better actor can sell ridiculous dialogue. Because everybody is talking utter shit through the whole film. Let's be honest. And for the most part, they sell it. I mean, a good actor can sell terrible dialogue.
I think in this case, you're right. I mean, Javier Bardem has some quite ludicrous lines.
He really does.
And he does get you in with them.
Mm.
So we differ a little bit on that, but I think we're generally pulling in a similar direction, I think, with this film. Engaging, visually interesting, some good moments, but it drowns itself with its dialogue and incompleteness.
Yeah, I mean, not one to always quote myself, but I'm particularly proud of a tweet that I wrote immediately after watching the film, where I called it a spectacular train wreck of glorious noir brilliance entangled in as much blundering ineptitude. And I hold by that.
I think that's one for the poster.
Okay, next, Fernando has seen a documentary that had a lot of buzz around it, sort of a year or two. It's an American documentary called Waiting for Superman. Now, I must admit, I haven't seen this film. So, Fernando, this one is all yours.
Yeah, this one was an Audience Award winner at Sundance.
That sounds right.
And got quite a bit of attention in the build-up to the award season. It must be 2011 award season now.
Mm-hmm.
And Waiting for Superman is a documentary that takes a fairly cold, hard look at the education system in the USA. It's written and directed by Davis Guggenheim, who people would recognize from An Inconvenient Truth.
Oh, yeah.
And before he did An Inconvenient Truth, he did a documentary, which must have been about 10, 15 years ago, looking at a short film, looking at teachers in the LA school system and asking some questions about what it takes to be a teacher in a difficult, poorer environment. And Waiting for Superman is a bigger, more ambitious look at the structural issues that are plaguing the US education system. And it's a little bit of a horror story. I mean, the US is in a big, huge, economically successful country, and yet when you look at the OECD rankings, you know, rankings for developed countries in education, in a lot of areas, the US has really fallen behind. And scores for students and social issues within schools are a really big problem. And this is despite the fact that every president for the last 30 years has made it one of their pledges to improve the school system. You know, and we see through Waiting for Superman, we see again and again, you know, stock footage of Obama or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter signing into law some new bill that will improve the education system in the US. But by and large, most of those acts don't deliver. And Waiting for Superman plays itself out on two levels. So on one level, we get to hear from educational reformers and government bureaucrats and people involved in teachers' unions about these big structural issues. You know, the contracts that pay teachers, the issues that are involved in dealing with underperforming teachers, how schools are funded. But we also trace the story of five kids who are mostly from poorer backgrounds, difficult upbringings, and they're trying to get into better schools. And so we trace their journey as, in effect, you know, these young kids, 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age, are trying, them and their families are trying to take responsibility for their educational destiny, get themselves out of underperforming schools where very few kids graduate and even fewer kids go on to college or four-year college, as they call it in the US, and get into better schools. And the film, I think, really succeeds at showing you this broader picture on both those levels. So we get this, you know, political, informative documentary, you know, and those scenes then cut to much more personal, the human story of the kids who are trying to go through. And a lot of these kids are preparing themselves for what is literally a lottery process, where numbers and names are more or less drawn out of the hat or out of a, you know, a lottery basket, like a bingo basket. For admissions to selective schools and what in the US are called charter schools. Because the kids are applying at rates, you know, there might, you know, one school there's like 10 places available and there's 120 applicants. You know, another school is 20 places available and 500 applicants. And perhaps the most shocking and depressing scenes which come towards the climax of the film are when the kids are in a giant room with their parents and hundreds of other kids and parents, literally waiting to see if their number comes out of the lottery.
Oh, God.
And they've got a place in a better school, or they're going to have to keep going to their, you know, underperforming school. And it is at times depressing, but at other times inspiring, look at all the layers that are involved in the education system in the US. And it's a well-constructed documentary. It's a well-paced documentary. It's one that I think, you know, kids will connect with, watching the experience of other kids in another place. It has been a political lightning rod in the US, not surprisingly. Certain aspects of the film have come under criticism. It's been seen by some as propaganda for charter schools and independent schools and selective schools. Certainly the teachers' unions don't come out looking terribly good in this. They do come out looking a little bit like they're trying to defend underperforming teachers. And of course, in a film that tries to cover the education system of a huge country in an hour and 40 minutes, it is prone to oversimplifying the issues at times.
Sure.
But I think as a dramatic, true-to-life representation of really a lot of structural educational problems that probably shouldn't exist in such a huge, economically successful country. It is interesting.
Yeah, no, it was definitely something on my radar at the time. You know, like you said, it got a lot of Sundance buzz, and then that did continue through the year. And then I just never got to see it, and then it kind of just sort of fell off my radar, as so many films do. But I'm definitely curious to see it. I mean, as a not as a parent, but as a former teacher, you know, I'm very interested to see see it from that perspective. I did have one question, though, about the situation. Is, you know, like you're saying, it has all these flashbacks to various presidents of putting new policies into law and what have you. So where does it seem to suggest that the disconnect is? Where do the policies fail in helping these sort of students? Is it on a school by school level, or is it sort of at a state level, or where is the money and the change, if you like, falling through the cracks?
I think there's two issues that really percolate up in the film. One is the question of how you assess whether a policy works or not. So to what extent are exams a good measure? Because, that was one of the common criticisms of the policy that George W. Bush put in, was that it was very well-intentioned and quite well-funded, but ultimately you're only really measuring on the basis of scores and numbers, and that doesn't necessarily tell you everything about what's going on in a school.
No.
But the real big villain comes down to what exists between the level of the school and the level of the boards at regional and state levels that manage schools. And particularly the issue that it's very difficult to shut down, reform, or change underperforming schools. So in a lot of places in the US, this is certainly the way the film represents it, it's almost impossible to fire underperforming teachers.
Wow, because of the unions?
Because of the unions, because of the kind of contracts they have.
Right.
It's almost impossible and very expensive.
So it sounds like a fantastic job.
Yeah, it's a fantastic job. I guess it depends on your willingness to let people down year after year after year, you have entire schools that fail again and again and again, and you have a lottery which is partly predicted on socioeconomic measures. So schools in poorer areas tend to be worse, right? And then schools in poorer areas, because they graduate fewer students and they graduate fewer employable students. I mean, this is an issue that comes up again, is what kind of student profile is required for the kinds of jobs that are going to exist now and in the future. So the film does raise, the fact that Silicon Valley, for example, is an extraordinary engine for wealth creation and innovation in the United States. But Silicon Valley employers actually find it difficult to recruit enough U.S. graduates. So there's actually, so Bill Gates makes his customary appearance there to talk about, the need to have to create more potential entrepreneurs and kids who are bright and able to do all these kind of technology jobs. But certainly schools in poorer areas contribute to the other social issues that are in the areas because they produce students who find it harder to get jobs. They produce fewer students who are able to go after better paid jobs.
Right.
And they produce more students who end up dropping, not just dropping out of school, but, dropping out socially. One of the most moving stories in the film is a young boy who is being raised by his grandmother. His mother left, father was, died young of drugs or something. We're not told, but something related to his drug addiction. And you see this pattern of generational underperformance. The struggle goes down from one generation to another, and it comes back to the schools with underperforming teachers, with principals who can't be moved on. So even the principals are not necessarily good. And this is a little bit where Waiting for Superman has been accused of being propaganda for charter schools and selective schools, because the film does definitely, it follows a number of educational reformers, and one of the key figures is a man called Jeffrey Canada, who works in Harlem in New York, has set up a number of charter schools, and is a quite outspoken leader in sort of regenerating and innovating education, newer approaches to teaching. And the film definitely takes that view that the largest part of the solution is better teachers.
Right.
Better teachers, better paid teachers, more innovative approaches to teachers, better and better administrators at the school level and at the regional level. And of course, I mean, as a parent living in Hong Kong, Singapore and Tokyo, I kept watching the film thinking, goodness, I've met a lot of really good American teachers in the last 10 years who don't live in the US, you know, who actually are out here in Asia teaching in some of the fantastic independent and private schools that we have, and getting paid a really good wage to do so. So that the teachers are around, but it's a question of, I guess, of producing more of them. And one thing the film doesn't touch on, which is a live issue, is how the schools can attract better quality graduates, basically make teaching more attractive as a profession.
Mm-hmm.
So pay is touched on a little bit, but other issues not so much.
Okay, so I mean, it's definitely a film to check out. And it seems to cover the topic quite extensively.
Very, very, very thought-provoking, very worthwhile, very well put together. And if you've seen An Inconvenient Truth, you know the kind of tone and approach to giving us facts at a macro level and also then telling us some human stories to flesh that out, which is really part of... Davis Guggenheim's approach to documentary filmmaking.
Excellent. Right, well, I'll have to check it out. I'm sure I'll find it on iTunes or something.
Yeah, iTunes brought it to my attention, and it's available on iTunes in Australia. Certainly it will be available on iTunes in the US. And I have seen the DVD around in stores as well.
Excellent.
Now, our last film is one that I haven't managed to see, but that doesn't matter because James has, and he's got pretty strong opinions about it. It's 12 Years as a Slave.
12 Years a Slave.
12 Years a Slave. The new, I think, really generating quite a bit of a buzz, historical feature film from Steve McQueen, starring Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I think some people are struggling to pronounce his name. Is that right, James?
Including your good self, if I must be honest. Yeah, as far as I understand, it's Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, there's something about the pronunciation of the first I in there that I've heard him pronounce it.
And oh, what would he know?
And it sounds like a diphthong, but I'm not going to dispute it. I want to hear about the film. Is this as good as everyone says?
Okay, well, what I can say, I mean, this is clearly awards bait every step of the way. It's essentially an adaptation of a true story written by the main character, who is called Solomon Northup, who was a free man in New York in the 1840s. So this is before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he is a man of education. He is a family man. He owns his own house, and you know, he has a good job, and he's an accomplished musician. And he is essentially tricked, scammed by a couple of sort of people who are introduced to him as, you know, reputable men who are going to give him a touring job with a musical troupe. You know, around the Northeast. He is essentially drugged and kidnapped and taken to the Deep South and sold as a slave. And because he loses his papers along the way, well, loses everything along the way, he is unable to prove who he is and is essentially just sold into slavery and warned by more experienced people along the way to, you know, shut up, keep your head down, go along with it, and just, you know, when you just try and escape at some point. Because if you let on that you can read, if you let on that you can write, if you start saying who you are, you're just going to get yourself killed. Mm. You know, and so it's an incredibly sort of tragic situation that he finds himself in. And before long, he finds himself on a plantation run by good old Michael Fassbender, playing the most deplorable slave owner, Cotton cotton plantation farmer imaginable who puts anybody in Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained to shame. I mean, this guy is vile to the core. And obviously, as all good white slave owners is, he has a bit of a thing for one of his lady slaves, and you know, so he's rife with contradiction, and it that does not obviously sit well with his wife,
mm-hmm.
and so there's, you know, he is under certain sort of conflicted pressures while being a vile racist at the same time, while, you know, and so he takes out his various frustrations and yearnings and lustful thoughts in increasingly violent and horrific ways. And unfortunately, Solomon Northup, who changes his name, he has to go under the name of Pratt. He gets increasingly sort of embroiled in this situation. I mean, it's directed by Steve McQueen, who's a black British director. It's his third film. I mean, he's an artist, essentially, and he came up through the fine art scene. He did sort of video installations and a number of different things, and, you know, he's a very highly acclaimed artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is his third feature film. All of his films have been collaborations with Michael Fassbender.
Hunger and Shame being the two previous ones.
There you go.
Yeah.
And here it's very interesting because it is, on the surface, an incredibly American story. And all the principals are actually British or Irish or from elsewhere. You know, Steve McQueen, the director, is British. Chiwetel Ejiofor, the main actor, is British. Michael Fassbender is Irish. You have Benedict Cumberbatch in there as well, and a number of others. I mean, one of the producers of the film is actually Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And you see Brad Pitt pop up again. He has a couple of scenes in the second half of the film. And it struck me that, like... are Brad Pitt and Michael Fassbender not allowed to be in more than two scenes per film together? Because if you look at Inglourious Basterds and then The Counselor and then 12 Years a Slave, it's like they have these great scenes together, but they're only allowed two each. And that otherwise it's too much awesome on screen in one time, I think.
It's being rationed out or else we all wouldn't be able to cope.
Exactly. They should do like a buddy cop film together or something.
They should do Waiting for Godot.
Oh my God, that would be great. Or Pinter's The Dumb Waiter or something like that, which I'm a big fan of. But so anyway, I mean, this is far and away Steve McQueen's most commercial film. It's, you know, Hunger was very much an artist working with cinema, and Shame was like a very contemplative character piece that went into some sort of interesting experimental places. This is played pretty straight. You know, it's a big Fox Searchlight production. It's got Oscar written all over it. And if I'm completely honest, while it doesn't really pull any punches along the way, I mean, we've all seen or heard enough stories about this period of American history to know what to expect. And in some regard, you can say, well, a lot of those stories were informed by Solomon Northup's writing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, because we've seen so many incarnations and adaptations, interpretations of this before now, to a degree, there's nothing new here. It's horrific and horrible and touching and moving and occasionally humorous and powerful and all of those things that we know it's going to be. And it hits those beats incredibly well. It does a good job of not being sentimental and being, you know, moving. And even somebody like myself, who has no connection with any of this subject matter whatsoever, is still able to sort of shed a tear and care for the right people and be very appalled by the behavior and all that kind of thing. You know, and it really hits its mark spectacularly well. And it will be very hard to mount a convincing campaign for, say, something like Gravity or Captain Phillips to win a Best Picture Oscar over this. I think this is I think this has probably got the Best Picture Oscar in the bag. I'd be very interested to see if they come Oscar time, they don't split the awards and you have someone like Alfonso Cuarón getting the Best Director Oscar for, you know, for such a technical achievement. Whereas Steve McQueen's his input here, I mean, well, obviously it's a great achievement what he's managed to accomplish. Mm. It's more subtle, it's more restrained than what we've seen him do in the past, and it's less obvious. And that may that may work sort of against him. But I think the film is very accessible, and it's, you know, it's challenging, but it's kind of that that one film this year. Every year there comes along a film that is just, you know, dripping awards bait and awards recognition, and this is certainly that film. But I don't think it should be held against it. I mean, the performances are uniformly great, with the exception, I'm rather disappointed to say that Benedict Cumberbatch, he's great, he's always great, but his accent isn't really there. His part is quite small, and it's towards the beginning of the film, but he plays the first slave owner.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a little more sympathetic than some of the later ones, but yeah, his accent's a bit all over the place, unfortunately.
So a slightly weak link in an otherwise very strong chain.
Sure, but I wouldn't want to. You know, it's hard doing accents, is really hard. And
I suck. They all sound the same when I do.
And what we have seen is that that has never been a hindrance in an actor's career, really. You know, apart from Jason Statham, who now doesn't have to do an accent really ever.
It's never held Hugh Jackman back.
Well, exactly. Or Ewan McGregor. He's appalling at accents. So I wouldn't call him a weak link.
Okay.
I think that's harsh. But Chiwetel Ejiofor is amazing, as we all know him to be. Everybody who's seen him in, you know, all those films before. Sci-fi nerds will recognize him from Serenity. He's the main villain. I can't remember what the character's name is in Serenity, but he's called like he's called like the counselor.
He's
or the
operative.
The operative. There you go. And he has that great scene where he makes a guy kind of fall on his sword and slide down it.
Yeah.
You know, and he's been around for a long time. And
he was very good
great.
In Love Actually. I have a very vivid memory of the first time I saw him was in Dirty Pretty Things.
Ah, yes.
Which
right.
was, I think it was either the opening or closing film for the London Film Festival, back when I lived in London many, many years ago. And that was a great performance. And I think then the next thing I saw him in after that was Love Actually.
Ah, right, yeah. Yeah, he's one of the friends, isn't he, at the... no, is he the... He's the groom, isn't
he's
he?
He's Keira Knightley's husband, yes.
That's right. And then Andrew Lincoln attempts to win her over.
Yeah. But he has been consistently somewhere between very good and excellent in
yeah.
almost everything he's done, pretty much, I would say.
Oh, yeah, he's uniformly reliable. Mm-hmm. You could certainly say that. And this is great to see him finally sort of break out and have like a proper sort of starring role in a film that's going to get him a hell of a lot of awards recognition. You know, whether he's going to win, we shall see. But he will be nominated at every award ceremony this year, and rightly so. And I think that's great. And I think that will put him, you know, it has the potential to put him in A-list standing for the foreseeable future, you know, right up there with sort of Denzel. I think he could easily be the next Denzel Washington. And he's British as well, which only helps.
Which just makes it all even better.
Right. Now, I mean, we were talking, I was talking with some friends last night, and we were talking about sort of who are our sort of awards favourites at the moment kind of thing. I could see Michael Fassbender doing very well for this part because he's a little bit, the roles that he takes are a little bit too eccentric for him to win for some gloriously heroic part. And I think people would feel very comfortably awarding him as the most vile villain imaginable. This is almost like his Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List.
Yes.
Part.
Okay.
You know, he's very good. It's a big part. You know, he's almost a co-lead, you know, but obviously this is not his story by any stretch, but he's in, you know, a good 2/3 of the film and is great, as we all know him to be, and has been consistently great for a number of years. And I think he's the kind of actor that people want to award, and it'll be very interesting to see how he fares this time out, because I think it's one of those performances that people will be more than happy to vote for, actually.
And particularly the way you present it as well, there could be quite a bit of momentum behind this film, so
There will be, for sure.
So picking up Best Supporting Actor nominations alongside I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I'm just guessing things like production and production design and so forth would also be potential categories for this film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, cinematography, editing, all that kind of thing. Costumes. The score. Yeah, costumes for sure. I mean, the score. What the one thing? Okay, if there is a negative, and there is one, which you've just reminded me of. Thank you. Is our good friend Hans Zimmer did the score, and it sounds identical in places to if you remember his score from one of your favorites, Inception.
Yes.
Not the big boom theme, but there's a kind of love theme in Inception.
Uh-huh.
There's a kind of softer love theme, which seems to sort of play on about four chords or four notes and just go back and forth and up and down these four chords rather slowly. That's almost identical to the main sort of theme in 12 Years a Slave. And every time it comes on, I'm like, Inception. No. Although, obviously, it's played on very different instruments and played very, you know, harmoniously and lyrically here in a way that it wasn't in Inception. But it that jarred me. And, you know, unfortunately, it's something that composers get picked up on time and time again. It's like, yeah, you used that refrain 10 years ago in something else.
Recycling themes and ideas. I mean, it's interesting. Mm. I would hate to feel like I'm being incepted when I'm watching a historical drama like this.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame.
And it is it's an interesting issue when you mention someone like Hans Zimmer, because, of course, people might not be aware of this, but normally when we watch a film that has an orchestral score, what we're listening to is music that's been recorded by an orchestra, right? So a composer writes the music, they hire an orchestra to play it, and then it gets played at a tempo that can be synchronized with the action on screen. The way Hans Zimmer works is he actually has a vast library of orchestral samples that he uses to piece together his score.
Right.
So it could actually well be that when you're listening to this piece of music, it's actually using the same bits, the same chunks, if you like, of orchestral sound being pieced together. And it's one of the issues. Hans Zimmer's becoming a little bit of a touchstone for conversation about how composition happens in contemporary films, because there is a level at which a lot of the percussion in Hans Zimmer scores sounds the same, because it is the same. It's actually the same sounds and the same performances being, you know, sampled and then replayed and reconfigured in a slightly different way. So it's not just the old thing of perhaps someone like John Williams borrowing, you know, a thematic idea from one film and using it in another. So it kind of reminds you of it on a sort of musical conceptual level. It's actually the same sounds,
right,
being reused and reconfigured to play a different score, maybe with different notes.
Right.
But
now that could prove an obstacle then in terms of sort of awards recognition, because I know the Academy certainly has very strict, if slightly inconsistent, rulings on previously recorded material being used again, and a number every year a number of scores get sort of ineligibilized by get discounted.
I'm not even going to try and contemplate whether that's a word or not. I'm just going to let that slide by. Well, it does, but I mean, it's one of the issues now. For example, whenever you listen to contemporary music, right, and you think about, say, a snare drum hit in a pop song, okay. Well, that might have been the drummer hitting that snare drum in the recording, right, while the band is playing.
Yeah.
But then the producer will layer over that a snare from a different song. So right. You could be listening to a Coldplay song, but actually the snare hit is Coldplay's drummer. But also layered on top of it is a drum hit from another band that the producer right. happened to have on his hard drive, and he's just layered it over because that will make it sound better. And that's the issue you have here with something like what Hans Zimmer does. You know, the scores are by and large original for each one. Obviously, every composer is riffing on ideas that they then reuse from time to time or recycle. But the performances, you know, what we're looking at is for example, with violin, it might be one note, right, that a violin is played. And that note is then being reused in a performance over and over again in different spots. So it pushes the envelope. It really pushes the envelope in terms of what original score is, because in music, a lot of stuff, when you get down to the micro level, we're recycling sounds all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's certainly, I'm not saying the score of 12 Years a Slave is bad, but that was one thing that certainly sort of jarred with me, is it felt, it was reminiscent of previous work. But all in all, the film is good, the film is solid, it's very good, but it's very good in that way that we all know that kind of film is going to be. We should give a little shout out to newcomer Lupita Nyong'o, who plays Patsy, mm-hmm. who is the young slave girl who is the object of Michael Fassbender's unwanted affections, and she gives a terrific performance mm-hmm. as well, and she's likely to see a lot of awards love as well. But so overall, yeah, it's good. It's probably it is as good as people say it is. But at the same time, it's the kind of film that more adventurous filmgoers might kind of shrug and go, yeah, well, it's just one of those films. So take from that what you will. But all that said, it's my vote right now. Were I a betting man, I would bet on it winning Best Picture.
We'll come back to that in the new year for sure. Now, in the meantime, my name is Fernando Gros. You can find me on Twitter, FERNANDOGROS. And you can find me on my website, www.fernandogros.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at Marshy00. Find us on Twitter at Society for Film. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSocietyForFilm. And find us on iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe. And rate us and leave us a review.
Exactly. So until next time, I'm Fernando Gros in Tokyo.
I'm James Marsh in Hong Kong. Goodbye.